Welcome to the Outsmart ADHD podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Coutinho, board-certified occupational therapist, two-time TED speaker, ADHD coach, ADHD advocate, and reality show contestant. Now, let's talk about ADHD. My friends, welcome back to the Outsmart ADHD podcast. Are you in as much shock as I am? Because I, across from me, virtually have Jessica McCabe, who you know from the How to ADHD channel, her TED Talk that blew up. She's a public speaker, award-winning YouTube channel host, and unofficially probably the coolest and most down-to-earth person on the planet. And one person in my community described you as the OG influencer in the ADHD world, and that's how it feels. Jessica, I cannot tell you how grateful I am that you're here and how excited I am to chat with you.
I'm so excited to be there. And anybody who knows my channel, hello, brains.
I love that. So Jessica, when reading your book, which I finished today, you had talked about, you started this channel because you were looking to gather all of these strategies for your ADHD brain. And you said, I know I won't lose YouTube. Is that true?
Yeah, no, it's 100% true. I knew that I wanted to learn some strategies for my brain. I wanted to learn what was going on, what I was struggling with, and what I could do about it. And I knew that there had been strategies here and there that I'd seen over the years, and they'd been really helpful for like a week until I forgot to use them. And then by the time I remembered to use them again, I couldn't find the article or I couldn't find the book. I couldn't figure out where I had seen it before. Yeah. But there was one video that I'd really liked on YouTube that I would be able to go and look up anytime I wanted to show it to somebody. So I'm like, okay, I lose notebooks, I lose phones, I lose, you know, my mom said I'd lose my head if it wasn't attached. I won't lose YouTube. So if I'm gonna do all this work, because I feel like so many people with ADHD, and I'm definitely one of them, do the work over and over again. At, like the same work, right? Like you go out of your way to learn a thing or to set up a system or whatever, and then like you lose it or you forget about it or whatever, and you end up doing all of that work all over again. So I'm like, if I'm gonna do this work, I need it to mean something. I don't want to have to do it over and over again. It feels like Groundhog Day sometimes. So, so I took everything that I learned about ADHD and about my brain as I was learning about it, and I put it somewhere I could actually find it again. And YouTube was literally the only place that I knew I wouldn't lose.
That's amazing. And can I ask, Jessica, do you ever go back to your videos when you're thinking like, oh crap, I want to learn about X thing? Do you ever go back to your videos and watch them for that reason?
So no, what I would do is I would write an episode and I'd really work on it a lot and do my absolute best. And then when I posted it, I would watch it again and again and again and again. But then I would move on to the next topic and then move on to the next topic. And it's only just now, this last couple of weeks, I've started going, you know what? I did a lot of work. I could go back to those videos and see what I learned. I think I learned so well by teaching it and by reviewing it immediately that a lot of it just stuck and I was able to remember it. But I started reviewing the old videos and doing like watch parties. So I just watched a video called Routines Over Resolutions and I'm like, wow, this really holds up. Dang, yeah. Thanks, past me. So now I'm finally at the point where I'm like ready to review what I did before. But for 7 years straight, it was just there was always something new to learn. So that's what I was focused on.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the book that the book was your first long-term project that you actually finished. But I see your YouTube channel and your consistency posting weekly as one heck of a project that you were consistent with. So I'm curious, do you see your YouTube channel as another big project that you actually did finish or not ever, you know, quote, finish, but...
Not really, because here's why. Those were all short-term projects, and that's the secret. Like, every video was a new video. There was, you know, at first it was one a week. So those were pretty short-term projects. I didn't set out to build a YouTube channel that would turn into a career. That wasn't the goal. It was just to learn something about my brain and put it on the internet and make it helpful or make it public in case if it's helpful for anybody else. But it was one at a time. It was very, very short-term projects. This was the first time I went, okay, the thing I'm creating isn't going to take me a week to create. It's going to take a year or year and a half to create. And I set out to do it. But when I finished it, what I realized was that I kind of had finished a long-term project that was part channel, part book, part all of this, which was I did set out to learn what I could about my brain and put it somewhere I could actually find it again. And after 7-8 years, I had learned pretty much everything there is to learn about the ADHD brain, right, and put it somewhere I could find it again, both on the channel and in a book. So that felt like I had not only finished the project of this long-term project of writing a book, but the long-term project that I had started out on in the first place. So it was kind of cool. It was like not only wrapping up a 2-year project of writing and promoting a book, but wrapping up this 7-8 year project of learning about my brain and putting that information somewhere I could find it again. The difference is I didn't start out thinking that was going to be a long-term project. I was like thinking it would take a couple of months, right? Like I'm just going to, yeah. I don't know, like I was trying to make dinner and I was going to run out to the store to grab some ingredients real quick and like hit pause on Netflix. Like I'll just be right back to my life. It's cool. But there was just so much more to learn than I ever expected. So 7 years later, I'm like, oh, I guess this was a long-term project. I just didn't know that at the time.
It's so funny because you described it just like that in your book too. Like, I'm just going to do this really quick and I'll come back and then it'll be done. And not knowing that you'd have a career out of it, which I think is just amazing. Oh, also, I wanted to mention or wanted to ask you, ADHD brain, of course. Do you feel like you had the same passion for teaching others like your mom did? Because you mentioned your mom was a teacher too, correct?
Yeah, it runs in the family. I don't know if it's an epigenetics thing. Like, I don't know where it came from, but my grandma was a teacher. I don't think I put this in the book. My grandma was a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse in Kentucky, K-12. Yeah, so she was teaching all the grades. And then my mom got her master's degree and she taught preschool and kindergarten, special education. So she was helping kids who had disabilities, and she was helping them to learn. A lot of times she was helping them to learn how to speak. She was a speech and language pathologist as well. So every summer since I was 5 years old, I got to volunteer in her classroom and help out. So I don't know if it was just like this ran in my blood or if it was I just really enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed helping out with kids who are struggling when I got to volunteer in my mom's classroom. But yeah, I did realize somewhere along the way, oh, there's a teaching element to this. This isn't just me sharing what I know. Like I'm teaching. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. How long into the YouTube channel were you before you realized like, holy crap, this is a lot bigger than what I had originally envisioned?
Hey, gosh. I think probably about 6 months in when me Googling things and learning that way turned into people coming out of the woodwork and being like, hey, there's research on this. Do you want to read actual research papers? I can teach you how to do that. Okay, cool. And then Google Scholar. Wow, that's a thing. Okay. And then it was PubMed. And it just became bigger and bigger where I'm like, this is deep. And there were times where I'd read these research papers with tears streaming down my cheeks because I'm like, these researchers know my brain so much better than I ever did. There's this incredible amount of information. So I went to an ABCT conference where like researchers were meeting and talking about this stuff. And I let them know, hey, you guys know all this stuff and we need to know this stuff. But right now we don't. At the time, I don't think anybody was really doing that. At least somebody just with ADHD who dropped out of community college certainly wasn't doing this science communication of reading these research papers and making this information accessible. So I talked to them and I was like, you're doing such good work and you know so many things, but the people who need to know how their brains work aren't getting this information because these research papers are behind paywalls. So what can we do? How can we disseminate this information? And I got a chance to reconnect with one of them recently who now works for a company that builds apps for kids to help them support their executive functioning. And he was like, that really stuck with me. I was there that day and that stuck with me. And it made me step out of the ivory tower and go, you know what? We need to bring this to the people.
Wow.
So it's cool seeing the ripple effects.
That's incredible. And also you have such a gift for taking that scientific information, which it uses language that doesn't make sense to a lot of people and making it make sense for the general population. And what an amazing gift that is.
Thank you. It didn't always feel like a gift. It just felt like, well, this is what I have to do to make it make sense to me. Mm-hmm. And I used to, in English class in high school, I used to feel like I wasn't that good of a writer because I couldn't do the really beautiful flowery language that I would see other people use. Like other people could take a leaf and describe it in these like gorgeous, beautiful, flowy terms. And I'm like, I can't do that. What I can do is take a lot of information and distill it down to something really simple. So I can take these really big, complex topics and make them simple, whereas other people could take these really simple things and make them beautiful and complex. Mm-hmm. I don't have that skill, but I can simplify. And at first I thought it was very like, I don't know. It just made me feel like I wasn't that good of a writer. And then I realized, no, that's a valuable skill too. So it's funny. Some of the things that we can be the most sensitive about can end up being the things that make us good at what we do. If we find the right job, if we find the right career, if we find the right passion, suddenly the things that we were, yeah, that they were self-conscious about become an asset. And that's definitely the case here.
It's so wild to hear you say, I didn't think I was a good writer, because listening to your book, I listened to the audiobook version. I mean, it is incredible. The amount of information that is in it, it's so engaging. You did an amazing job pretty much taking your YouTube channel, like you mentioned, taking all of your best strategies, packing it in, and it's so much more than strategies. Guys, if you have not bought the How to ADHD book yet by Jessica McCabe, go and run and read it right now, because it is just incredible.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You did such an amazing job with that book. And I want to know, how daunting was it to write? You mentioned it was a 2-year process.
Yeah, it was 2 years total. So usually if you go with a traditional publisher, they're going to give you about a year to write. That can get extended a little bit, but not much. There was a time, I think it was a few months past, and my editor was like, okay, really, this is like the last extension we can give you. We really need to get this out.
Yeah.
Because they have the publish date all lined up in advance, and there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen after you're finished writing it before it's ready to go to print. And then there's a lot that, you know, that happens from there before it's ready to hit the bookshelves. So we were really up against the wire with it, but it was about a 2-year process total. So I started in January of 2022, and it was published in January of 2024.
That's incredible.
But yeah, it was a long and intense process. And yeah, it was really daunting. And I knew it would be, because I not only wanted to write a book, which I had never done before, mm-hmm. but I wanted to write a book that would give people the experience that they would have if they binge watched my channel and saw my TEDx talk and hung out in the comment section or our Discord. We have a private Discord through Patreon for the people who support us, who donate to us. And there's some really cool conversations that happen there. And then also like sat down and had coffee with me. Like I wanted to give them this experience that I knew changed lives, because it changed mine. It changed so many other people's, to be able to learn all this information and connect with this community and learn strategies, not just from experts, but from each other. And I needed to do it all in one book, and I had no idea how I was going to pull that off. Certainly not in the time frame that I was given. I asked originally for 18 months to write it, because I was like, you know, time and a half. Like, it's good for people with ADHD to have extra time.
Absolutely.
And they were like, they just kind of looked at me and blinked. And my business manager explained, no, like the way publishers work is it is a year timeline. And if you write past that, they start pulling resources. So aim for a year. Okay. So I did. And it probably took me, with editing and everything, close to 18 months. But it probably would have taken longer if I'd had 18 months to begin with. So, you know, it ended up working out. But yes, to answer your question, I just went on a million tangents. But yes, to answer your question, it was an incredibly daunting project and all-consuming at times.
I was going to say, did you have a life outside of writing this book for the time that you were writing?
I'm not sure I really had a life outside of the channel at all. Like I put a lot of my life on hold, because again, I thought I was like hitting pause on Netflix and running out to the store to get some ingredients real quick. Like, oh, I don't have what I need to cook dinner. I need to go get some ingredients. It was like that. Like I clearly don't have what I need to be successful at life. So let me hit pause on my life and like go collect the tools and strategies and understanding that I need and come back. So it's really been all consuming in general. But definitely while I was writing the book, it was pretty intense. There was a period of a couple of years with the channel where I was trying to have like a work-life balance and, mm-hmm. you know, be done at 6 p.m. at night and stuff like that. Whereas at first it was, when I first started the channel, it was like from the time I woke up in the morning to the time I went to bed at night, 7 days a week. And then I stopped to like go wait tables because I needed to make a living. And even then I was still having ideas and jotting things down. It was like it was hyper-focus. It was straight hyper-focus and hyper-fixation maybe even because I just – this was important. I just, there was something in me that told me that no matter what else there was for me to do in my life, like this was the single most important thing that I could do. And it needed to be done. So I sacrificed a lot. I put a lot of my life on hold. And so now I'm kind of excited because I get to hit play on my life again. I get to start figuring out what I want to incorporate in my life besides just work, besides learning all this stuff, because I did it, you know, I finished this project.
Absolutely. And you mentioned in the book that those 7 years were geared towards self-improvement, and now you're gearing the next chapter towards self-fulfillment. Is that how you?
Yeah. 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 That's exactly it. Like 7 years is quite enough. And I kind of want to model that for people too. It's like, yeah, it's important to learn about your brain. It's important to work on this stuff. It's important to improve your skills and all of that. But I also don't think that we should spend our whole lives trying to be somebody that we're not, or trying to do better than we are. At some point, we should be allowed to enjoy our lives. And one of the big revelations for me at the end of this book was that didn't have to wait until I learned all these tools and strategies, because I set out to learn all these tools and strategies thinking at the end, then I'll be successful and I won't struggle and I'll be this mm-hmm. person I'm supposed to be and all these things. And that's not, it turns out, how it works. So I could have been there for the people that I love in the ways that I could have then. I didn't have to wait to be this different version of myself. I didn't have to wait until I knew all the things and had all the tools to do all that. And so I, you know, I'm hoping that for those who make it to the end of the book, and for those who are listening to this podcast, whether or not you make it to the end of the book, that you keep that in mind, that like as you're working on self-improvement, as you're learning these things, that you also make time for the things that are important to you in your life. Because if you wait until all your work is done, you know, a lot of us are just never going to get to go play outside. You know, a lot of us are never going to get to have time for friends if we don't carve that out, because if we're waiting to be done, if we're waiting to be on top of our shit, like, I don't know if it's okay to say that.
But. Oh my gosh. I meant to ask okay. you before the podcast started. I'm just like, sometimes I curse. So that's what I meant by sentence enhancers. So if it offends you, tell me. But so I'm assuming it doesn't.
No. Oh, that's sentence enhancers. Okay. So you said you use sentence enhancers sometimes, and I Googled it and I was like, oh,
that
okay. And it was
so
like a
funny.
Whole AI thing. And uh-huh. I was like, oh, I thought it was something that you did in any. Okay.
That is so funny. No. And it's so funny. I'm just like, I think she'll understand. Maybe she will. I don't know. I'm just like, do I have to spell it out? Well, I seem silly if I spell it out. Of course, my ADHD brain was thinking. So anyway, continue. What were we talking about, Jessica?
Oh, yeah. No, I actually remember. If we wait until we have our shit together to live the lives that we want to live, we might be waiting a really long time.
Yeah.
And so my hope is that by giving people this information in one book, they don't have to spend 7 years learning all this stuff on their own. They can read it in a book and have that information at hand and continue to live their life. And I don't know. I have a lot of hopes that moving forward, we can be who we are and we can achieve who I have a lot of hopes that moving forward, people with ADHD can be who they are and achieve what they want to achieve and have time for play and have time for friends and not have to spend that time feeling guilty or shameful because they're quote unquote supposed to be doing something else.
Mm. I feel called out in the best way as a new business owner that feels like I have to, it's a lot in the beginning. It's a lot. And feeling like, oh, I don't have time for, you know, that call to even a family member or a friend. But you're saying it's so important to carve out that time. Now,
because otherwise you never get to the point where you have it, right? Like there's this like, oh, when I get to this point, like I just need uh-huh. to, I just need to graduate college, or I just need to get through this, you know, this interview process, or I just need to get, you know, settled into my new job, or I just need to get through this pregnancy, or I just need to get through this, mm-hmm. you know, this wedding planning or whatever, and then I'll have time. And that's the mm-hmm. lie. It's a lie for most of us. It's a lie. And so I'm really big on hopefully now encouraging people to at least a little bit, like maybe not a lot, right? If you're in grad school, you're not going to be able to like take lavish vacations, obviously. Mm-hmm. But like, can you spend 15 minutes a day planning a vacation for yourself for like when you graduate and just like imagining what that would be like? Or can you, you know, maybe you don't have time for a 3-hour phone call, but can you send a 15-second text, right? Like, can we do little parts of what we want to do so that we're not putting things on hold until when? Because when, I have learned, does not come. It just doesn't. Not for
us. Yeah. There's always the next thing, mm-hmm. next thing right around the corner. I took I took notes, Jessica, because it turns out that our brains do not hold on to all of the information the way that we would love it to sometimes. So if you see me looking over, that's what I'm doing. Do you see ADHD as a superpower, a disability, or both?
I see it as...
Or neither. Okay.
So, okay, it is technically a disability. So so is pregnancy. So is, you know, a lot of things. Anything that limits one or more major life activities is considered a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So that's important because disability has a lot of stigma attached to it, but it's not a bad word. It just means that society is not set up to accommodate our needs. That's really what it comes down to. And that's what helped me is understanding the social model of disability. I also am very nearsighted, which would be a disability, except we happen to have, you know, great contacts and glasses available. So I'm not disabled by my inability to see because that is properly accommodated, right? But if I didn't have glasses, if I didn't have contacts, that would 100% be a disability. I wouldn't be able to drive. I'm very nearsighted. I wouldn't even be able to sit in a classroom and learn because, you know, if the teacher writes anything on the board, I wouldn't be able to see it. So yes, ADHD is a disability. In terms of the superpower, I think that ADHD itself is not a superpower. Mm-hmm. It's, first of all, it's polygenetic. There are many factors. There are a lot of symptoms involved. And it does put us at risk for some pretty negative life outcomes, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But it does come with strengths because there are traits to ADHD. And those traits can really hurt us in some situations, but they can really serve us in others. So I'm impulsive, right? And that makes it really hard for me to manage my money. But it also made me really good at, you know, impulsively starting a YouTube channel, impulsively Googling things that I'm curious about, impulsively agreeing to do a TED Talk. Like, there are a lot of ways that my impulsivity has served me. Mm-hmm. And so I don't and then even hyperfocus, right? There are times where my hyperfocus has lost me opportunities or friends or whatever because I hyperfocused right through something that was really important. Mm-hmm. But it also helped me write a book. So I think that there are these traits that we tend to have, their brains tend to have, that can flip to the positive or the negative. And my goal in, you know, in providing people with the understanding and tools and strategies is to flip that more to the positive than to the negative. The people who say ADHD is just flat a superpower often come from a position of privilege, I've noticed. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
They have a lot of supports around them. They have a lot of kind of people picking up their slack. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they can do the things that they're good at and not have to really worry about the fallout because they are financially privileged or they have a lot of support or, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times it's like, it's a man who has a wife who's handling all the executive function stuff.
Right.
So he can like go into his office and be creative. So I think it's important to recognize if ADHD feels like a superpower, that it doesn't for everybody because there is a certain amount of privilege involved in being able to just focus on the things that you're good at, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of us needed to learn how to be on time and how to, you know, how to do a lot of the things that people with ADHD genuinely struggle with. And it doesn't feel like a superpower to a lot of us. So I don't think in and of itself it's a superpower. I think it's very situation dependent, how it shows up and how much we're able to utilize our strengths.
Absolutely. And I love that you talked about that in the book too, that depending on your race, depending on the culture, it can be harder to get diagnosed. It can be harder to find those strategies. It can be just all of it can be so much more challenging dependent on the situation that you're in and factors that are completely outside of your control.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of systemic issues involved. And, you know, ideally, like, the world becomes more ADHD friendly and we all learn the tools and strategies that we need and we have the access to support we need. And it can feel like a strength for everybody. But, you know, the truth is that and the research says that it's not.
Yeah.
Not on its own.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jessica, you run a very successful company. You're a public speaker. You're an author. What strategies do you use to not keep it together, because do we ever really have it together? But what strategies do you use to do all of the things all of the time?
Well, the biggest one is I don't do all of the things very intentionally. There's a phrase that kicks around the ADHD community that I really like. It's like, if you want to do more, do less. So the first thing that I had to do is stop saying yes to everything. the more we're trying to do, the harder it is on our executive function, frankly. So I used to think, oh, well, you know, find the right organizational strategy to manage all the things, and that's the solution. Mm-hmm. But the same reason why we need these organizational strategies is the same reason why it's hard for us to stick to them, which is that it's not how our brains naturally work. And so it's not about finding the right system. There is no magical system. My operations director said this, and I put it in the book. There is no magical unicorn tool that will solve all your ADHD woes. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So rather than trying to find the system that can help us manage all the things and do all the things, we really need to stop trying to do all the things and be picky about what we do. And that can bring up FOMO for a lot of us. Like, we're afraid of missing out because, like, what about this? And, you know, what about this opportunity? And it's like a really exciting opportunity. It's like, cool. Have you ever heard the parable of the dog with like the steak in its mouth, and it goes and looks at the water and sees another dog with a steak in its mouth, and like the dog the dog opens its mouth to like grab that other steak, but the steak that's in its mouth falls out. That's kind of what it's like. Like, if we go and chase too many things, then we lose the things that we already have. And so I've tried really hard to be selective about what I commit to. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. It's really hard. But it's, I think, really important for us to recognize, like, we cannot do all the things, or we can, just not all at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you decide what you're going to say yes to and what you're going to say no to? Because I can imagine that you have people contacting you all the time because of the amazing work that you do. How do you decide who you're going to say yes and who you're going to say no to?
It's really hard, but I do a balance of, is this, I think about the impact that it's going to have, the level of impact. So if I'm going to, let's say I'm going to be on a podcast. If the podcast has a huge audience and then another podcast has a smaller audience, I know I'm going to reach more people with the podcast with a huge audience, right? And so like, I'll do that. Or if it's something where it's for a company and I'm only going to be speaking to 150 people as opposed to 10,000 people, then, you know, then I need to be compensated because that's time that I could spend helping 10,000 people, right? And so if I'm going to go speak to 150 people, then I need to make sure that I'm compensated so that then I can use that money to hire editors and do the work that's going to reach more people. So I try to make sure that I'm going to be able to impact as many people as possible, which is why I chose to do the book. I knew that it would reach a lot of people in a lot of different languages. It's already being translated into like 10 different languages, which is really cool.
How amazing is that?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a ton of work, but I knew that the impact would be really huge. And so it's really that. So like if the impact is huge and it's going to be in line with my values and what I'm trying to accomplish, then I'll choose that. If the impact is not going to be as huge, then I need to make sure that it's at least funding the ventures that will create that impact, because I have really lofty goals for the channel. And this, you know, there's goals for my personal life too, but this is just for the channel. Like, I know what I'm trying to accomplish, and I want to make sure that I'm choosing the opportunities that are going to give me the best chance at accomplishing that as quickly as possible. Because the truth is, we're struggling. We're struggling out here. You know, there's so many people who don't understand how their brains work and who are living in just piles and piles of shame because it breaks my heart, because it's like they're ashamed because they're struggling, but they're struggling because they're not getting the support that they need.
Right.
You know, it's not a personal failing. It's not a moral defect. There's a disability there that is not being accounted for, that is not being accommodated. And it's heartbreaking because to put it in physical terms, it's like somebody who's in a wheelchair struggling to get up the stairs and blaming themselves for not being able to do it. It's like, well, no, you need a ramp, you know?
Right.
Like, it's not your fault that there's not a ramp, but that's how it is for people with ADHD. We're essentially struggling to get up the stairs and kicking ourselves for not being able to, because we feel like we should. We feel like we should be able to do this.
Oh my gosh. Even the way that you frame your answers, it just breaks everything down so beautifully and puts it so tangibly in a succinct way. Thank you. That makes complete sense.
Thanks.
I had a couple of questions off of that. They'll come to me. About the financial thing. Have you always been good about saying yes to opportunities that made sense financially, or to know your worth and your value and your goals? Because I know No. Okay. I was going to say that is not something that typically comes natural to women, let alone women with ADHD.
No. And in fact, at first, it was very important to me that I never charge for any of this ever, because I knew that I had not been able to afford it. When I first started learning about ADHD, I was pretty broke, and I had never been able to afford an ADHD coach or anything like that, or the level of support that I needed. And so I wanted to make this information freely accessible to everybody. I never wanted to charge anybody. I never wanted to ask for any money. I just wanted to do this because I was passionate about it. Kind of like a lot of artists are like, well, I don't need to get paid for my art. Like, I just love doing it, right? Well, the thing is, it takes time to do these things. And at some point, I was waiting tables, and I was spending money on doing this because I had to take time off work if I needed to spend longer writing something because I was behind schedule or filming or whatever. I had to buy equipment. You know, it ended up getting really expensive, but also it was more and more work. The more people watched, the more people were commenting, the more people I wanted to engage with and respond to. And then there were podcast opportunities coming up, and then the TEDx talk. There were so many opportunities coming in, and I wasn't getting compensated for any of it. And I was doing all of this on top of my regular job waiting tables. And at some point, I just burned out. Like, it was like my brain went on strike and just went, I refuse to keep working under these conditions.
Right.
I need somebody to like give me a dollar and tell me that something, you know, I just need somebody to give me like a dollar and tell me that what I'm doing is worth something to them. So this like really noble, altruistic, but also like probably undervaluing what I had to offer, right? Like, absolutely. As soon as you start charging for what you do, you're like, but is it actually, am I worth it? Like, should I charge for this? Like, is it good enough? And I was like, you know, what I'm doing is definitely good enough for free. Like, it's definitely good enough for that. But like, once you start charging, there is that internalized like sense of, you know, especially as a woman, like, do I deserve this? And the imposter syndrome and feeling like a fraud and all of that.
Yeah. Like, do you ever struggle with that now, of feeling like, do I really deserve, you know, this compensation or this opportunity?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Really? So Jessica McCade struggles with this?
100%. Yes. And there's a reason, like, I have a business manager now who handles the financial side of things. Because like, I still would do all of this for free if I could. Right. Like, I still struggle sometimes to go, you know, is this actually worth it? Like, is what somebody's paying me, you know, are they going to be happy with what they're getting for their money and stuff? And also, I really do love it, and I really believe in it and stuff. So, yeah, I've learned I should not be in charge of asking for money. I should not be in charge. And, like, there's still sometimes where people reach out and offer me money for something. And, like, my first instinct is like, oh, no, I'll do it for free. Forgetting that, like, time is a limited resource. Energy is a limited resource.
Absolutely.
Like, so I'm trying to accept it when people want to pay me. And I'm trying to let my business manager negotiate fees when – I'm not being compensated the way that I should be, but it is still hard. It's definitely something that I still struggle with. And I try to remind myself, like, these, you know, a lot of times are market rates, and like, if somebody's paying you, it's because they have that budget or they're getting something out of it too. Mm-hmm. But that sense of, am I enough? Like, do I deserve this? Or the guilt about it is tough. We're getting deep now.
Yeah, we are, but I personally love it because we don't know how to have surface level conversations as ADHDers anyway.
No,
so I didn't expect anything else. But that's very, very interesting to me that after nearly a decade still have that you still have to fight that initial gut reaction of, oh no, I'll do it for free, discounting how important your work is, and that time and energy is a very limited resource. And also, you're expecting right now, which I'm assuming is making time and energy even less of a resource.
It is, yeah. And childcare is not cheap, and so I'm trying to remember that. But I mean, it's the ADHD urge to, like, it almost feels like if you're excited about something, there just will be time and energy in your day to do it. And it's been hard to realize, like, that's not how it works. That, you know, any time and energy you spend on something is time and energy you can't dedicate to something else. So you do have to make sure that stuff is worth it for you. And that extends not just through work, but through friendships too. I used to go and do things for friends, and I don't know, I would be friends with people who treated me badly, and it wouldn't occur to me, like, this is time and energy that I could be spending on friendships with people who do treat me well. Or, you know, valuing your time and efforts is, I think, a complicated thing for a lot of people with ADHD, and definitely those of us who are socialized female, because we've been told that it's not valuable, that what we do is not good enough. We've heard so many of those messages. And, you know, women are often not paid for their labor, mm-hmm. You know, emotional labor, mental, the mental labor, childcare, like these are all generally unpaid. Mm-hmm. And so between that and being told that you're not doing enough or you're not good enough as somebody mm-hmm. with ADHD, or that you're making these mistakes, it's really hard to value what you have to bring to the table.
Absolutely. So what you're saying for all of the listeners, which our population is primarily people socialize as women with ADHD, you're saying charge for your business, right? Charge for what you do and put your Jessica McCabe stamp of approval on it.
Yeah, value your time, really, because even if you're not, you know, even if you're not 7-8 years into it, you still have all the skills and talents that you uniquely bring to the table, and that is worth something. And if you need to talk with other people who are doing the same kind of work and see what they're charging, that's been helpful too. Talking to other ADHD advocates who are like, yeah, sometimes we're asked to do things for free that are really inappropriate, and we're not going to do that. We're going to value our time, and we're going to charge what we're worth. And that's been helpful too, knowing that it's not just you. You're not the only one in the world charging for this, right?
Like, right.
Other people charge for these things too.
Right. And so I love that you say how you find out what to charge, because I personally had no idea what to offer you when I reached out. I'm just like, okay, this is my maximal budget. I'm going to offer my maximal budget for this minimal time. And I know if she says no, then I tried my best. So that's interesting that that's how you go about it, is talk to other people of, okay, this is what you're charging. Great. I know I can charge similar, or it sounds like that's kind of the process you take.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually.
Yeah.
Or again, I let my business manager handle it, or, you know, or I go with what somebody's budget is. A lot of times it's like, okay, what's your budget? And let me give you the best that I have to give you that fits within that budget.
Yeah.
And if somebody's budget is, you know, you can also not say yes or no, you can say something in between. So, you know, there are times where if somebody really wants me to come speak or something, but they don't have the budget for it, it's like, cool. All right. Well, can we do it virtually? Can we do it where it's a talk I've already given before? Can we do it, you know, a half an hour instead of an hour or whatever it is? But yeah, it is important to value your time.
Yeah. Now, do you enjoy public speaking in the same way that you enjoyed creating your YouTube channel, since, you know, you can't edit what happens on a stage? I'm just curious of how you feel about public speaking versus like a more curated channel.
I still script my talks, actually, because I do get nervous if I am speaking off the cuff. So, you know, doing podcasts is a challenge. Doing the vlogs that I do on the channel is a bit of a challenge, because I can't script it and then revise it and like run it by people and be like, you know, have that extra check that helps my anxiety. Like, is this okay? Is what I'm saying okay? Mm-hmm. So there are times, you know, and this comes from a whole lifetime of feeling like I put my foot in my mouth or being laughed at or criticized or bullied or whatever, right? Like there's been a lot of my life where I've tried to express myself and it has not gone well. Either because I'm tripping over my words, or I'm going off on tangents, or like something comes out the wrong way. Or sometimes I've just been in abusive relationships where people twist my words and make me feel bad about, you know, about what I'm trying to say. So I still have a lot of anxiety around speaking off the cuff. I've gotten better at it and more practiced, and that if anybody has anxiety, it's something really good to know. The way to deal with anxiety is not to avoid doing the thing, because that actually can make the anxiety worse.
Right.
It's to do it. You know, it's exposure therapy, essentially. Like you expose yourself to the situation that you're anxious about, and eventually it gets a little easier. But, you know, you have to kind of build up your window of tolerance over time. And that's basically what I've done, is I've gotten used to it and stuff. But there's still that, you know, oh God, am I going to say the wrong thing? And then when I get off of a it doesn't matter if it's like a social event or a podcast or, mm-hmm. you know, a vlog. I'm like, what did I say? Did I fuck it up?
It's really refreshing to hear or that someone that has achieved the success that you have still has those things that you have to grapple with. I mean, like you said, ADHD doesn't go away. And the people who have anxiety, depression, autism, anxiety, depression, sometimes those symptoms get better with time or with treatment. But our ADHD does not go away. And we have to run with it our entire lives and deal with it the best way that we can. So it's very interesting to hear that you still have anxiety of talking off the cuff, because I would never know talking to you right now that you have any anxiety about this.
Thanks. I'm like fidgeting with a battery. I don't know where my fidget toys are, but there was a battery on my desk, so I'm like super fidgeting with that. Fidgeting can help with focus, but it can also help a lot with anxiety. So usually fidgets are something that I use to help me with that. It doesn't go away. Like the lifetime, the history that we have with all of the corrections that we've gotten, all of this negative feedback, like that's not something that goes away just because we know what we're dealing with or we have strategies. Mm-hmm. It's just learning to live with it effectively, honestly. And it's definitely better than it used to be. I used to feel like I had to hide all of my struggles, and I would never have talked openly about them on a podcast like this, right?
Yeah.
It was terrifying talking about them publicly on YouTube, and I really hoped that nobody who actually knew what they were talking about would ever find my videos. It's like, I hope the people who need this find it and it's helpful for them, but like, I hope no expert ever sees any of this, because like, I'm pretty sure that I shouldn't be doing this. That anxiety, it doesn't, at least for me, it doesn't completely go away, but you learn how to live with it. But that's one of the reasons why I really urge people to, whatever it is you're waiting on, don't mm-hmm. wait for it, because it might not happen, right? Like, if you don't have to wait, don't wait completely. I'm not saying like, you know, you shouldn't, you know, I don't know, like reward yourself for finishing a thing. I think mm-hmm. that can be helpful, but even then, sometimes like it's good to pair the rewarding activity with the effort that you're already putting in. So mm-hmm. I used to do that with my writing. Is I would go to this is called Triple Eight. It was a Chinese food restaurant that had a late night happy hour that was right next to my work when I was waiting tables. And I would go there after work, and I would sit there and have their happy hour, not drinking. I would just have like tea and wonton mm-hmm. soup or whatever. But I'd have that while I was working on a script. And so I started associating this really difficult thing with this pleasant thing. And eventually I started enjoying writing. And I think that's good. And I kind of want people to live their lives that way. Like, if you're doing hard things, like, make sure that you're doing nice things for yourself too. And that you're not just like putting all of that off until someday. Or until when, because when doesn't always happen.
Right. And also just pairing the rewarding thing with the task that's a pain in the ass. I mean, I'm assuming that it helps with dopamine. It helps us to get through to actually do the thing, and is just a really helpful strategy in and of itself. That's one of the first things I teach my clients is pairing, and people on the podcast, is pair that thing that's a pain in the ass with something that makes you happy. If you mm-hmm. need to like listen to a podcast while you're doing the dishes, you will not catch me doing the dishes and not listening to a podcast or an audiobook. The amount of cleaning and stuff that I got done while listening to your audiobook, Jessica, it was fantastic. But that's just an amazing strategy, period.
Yeah, and you're right. The science behind it is the dopamine. So there was a talk that I went to at CADAC in Canada. It's a conference, an ADHD conference in Canada. And somebody was talking about this. It was newer research at the time. It was a few years back, but it was really, really intriguing to me. They were talking about how neurotypical brains start to associate tasks with a positive outcome or with the reward that they're going to get at the end of it. And their brains start releasing this anticipatory dopamine. So if you're filling out a form that's going to lead to a tax refund that you're going to get to go take a vacation with, your brain's already releasing anticipatory dopamine that's rewarding you for doing the tax form.
Wow. Well,
with people with ADHD, our brains don't, you know, they might release a little bit, but it's not nearly the same level. And so neurotypical brains are literally rewarding them for doing the thing while they're doing the thing in a way that our brains don't. And so if we can reward ourselves while we're doing the thing, that kind of helps to bridge that gap.
That is wild to think that a neurotypical brain, they are starting to get that dopamine release, that feel good neurotransmitter mean, while they're doing the thing, that just blows my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas for us, it's like, it can feel horrible. Like it can actually be physically painful if it's, you know, tasks are lengthy and repetitive and boring. Those are so hard for our brains. And part of it is because our brains are not being rewarded for doing them in the same way that neurotypical brains are. So, you know, it's just recognizing that and going, you know what, like, if you ever feel like you shouldn't need it, your brain literally does. Your brain is not being given the same advantages as a neurotypical brain. You're not getting the same levels of dopamine. So you have to pair it. There is a teacher who had a kid who was struggling with homework, and she was like, okay, you know, here's a bag of M&Ms. When you finish your homework, you can have the bag of M&Ms. Mm-hmm. And that did nothing. So what she ended up doing was she took, and this is in the book too, she took the bag of M&Ms, she ripped it open, and she put an M&M next to each problem. So the kid would do one problem, eat an M&M. Next problem, eat an M&M. And that's what worked.
And that's brilliant. I love that part of the book too. There's just so many parts of the whole damn book was amazing. The whole book was amazing, but I loved that part. I know we've just got a little bit of time left. I want to touch on, you had mentioned that there's not a lot of research to suggest that there's a big correlation between like screen time and difficulty sleeping. And I'm just like, well, I need to go back and change my coaching modules, because the one on sleep talks about not doing screen time. But you had mentioned that it's not necessarily screen time. It's just as long as you're doing something that lets your brain wind down, whether that be maybe an app on your phone or TV or something that just talk to us more about that, because that was amazing to learn.
Yeah, I was surprised about that too, because I had heard before that, like, no screen time, like 2 hours before bed or 3 hours before bed or whatever. And of course, I never was able to do that, because the funny thing is, like, watching TV, especially episodes that are reruns, stuff that I've seen before, is often how I wind down at night. It's how a lot of people wind down at night. And so without that, I would end up doing other things or starting projects or whatever, and I'd overstimulate my brain, and I actually would have a harder time sleeping. So sometimes trying to follow this advice can be counterintuitive. What the research does suggest is that having screens in the bedroom is not good for sleep. And that to me makes sense. So I usually will watch TV or something and wind down before bed, but I'll watch TV downstairs. And when I start to get sleepy, then I'll go upstairs and I'll go to bed. And at that point, I won't use screens. But my partner does. There's exceptions to the rule, right? Like, he has bad anxiety and CPTSD. And so it's for a lot of people with ADHD, at night when you're in bed is when all these thoughts flood into your head. Of all the things that like could happen or that you didn't do or that you need to do or whatever. And so he needs to distract himself. So he'll read a Wikipedia page, right? And so for him, it still makes sense to have the screen in the bedroom. And is it the best, you know, is it the best thing? Maybe not. Like, maybe reading a book might be better, but like, this is his routine. This is his ritual. This is how he winds down. So it can be different for everybody. But one of my favorite strategies for not using screens at night, because if my phone's there, like, I'm going to pick it up. Right.
Right.
Is to put it in the bathroom, like put your charger in the bathroom. And that's where your phone goes. Right. Uh-huh. So you can still hear, if you need the alarm, you can still hear the alarm go off. And then there's also the benefit of when the alarm goes off, if you want to turn it off, you actually have to get up out of bed, which can also help with waking up in the morning. But that way, if you wake up in the middle of the night, you're not tempted to grab your phone and play games or read on it or whatever. If you want to go do that, you can, but you have to get out of bed, which is what the research suggests, is like, don't, you know, use the bed for sleep and other stuff.
Right. I love that. And so what's the direction of the YouTube channel? Because you mentioned that you have big goals, but also that this next chapter of your life is more for fulfillment versus self-improvement. But also, you're going to be a new mom here really quick. So what is the direction of the YouTube channel, of your career? Just tell us more about it.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure that out because it kind of came as a surprise to me that I finished this long-term project of learning to work with my brain, not against it, and putting the information somewhere I could find it again. I didn't realize until I turned in the book, like, oh, I finished it. I don't think I've ever finished a long-term project. I've gotten distracted from them and I've started off on new goals and new paths, but it's never been like, okay, and now that's done. Now what? I've never been in that position before, ever.
Yeah.
It's always been like I dropped out of school to do something else, or I got distracted, or whatever, or I gave up. I got frustrated. I got discouraged. I had never like finished something and gone, now what? So it was really difficult for me, actually. And I had some vague ideas of what I wanted, and I spoke to those in the book. But I've been thinking about it a lot and talking about it. And I think the plan is to realize, like, I'm done at this point personally learning about ADHD. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I'm done teaching about it. I can still teach stuff that I've already learned, and I can actually get really creative with that and start thinking about, instead of just let me info dump all the things that I learned so that I don't lose it, I can start to think, okay, how can this information best be presented? And maybe start doing some Instagram carousels that are a little sticky that, you know, hopefully will help people remember these concepts, or I can present them in different ways and challenge myself to do a really good job teaching them, because we don't generally as humans learn well by just having somebody hook us up to a fire hose of information, which is essentially what a lot of my older videos were. Uh-huh. It was just like, here's everything that I learned about this one topic, right? So I want to still put out videos and content and posts across platforms that are educational about ADHD. But in terms of my personal journey, I'm relearning how to be a parent with ADHD. And there's a lot of content about how to parent a child with ADHD, but there's not as much about how to cope with parenting when you have ADHD, where it's not about the child. It's about, you know, are you getting triggered now? How's your emotional regulation? How are you coping when you don't get sleep? And how are you structuring your day and managing things when it's not just your life you're managing, but also a child's, you know, all of these things. So I think I'm going to speak some to that. But in terms of the ADHD, I think I'm moving past the, like, compared to neurotypical stencil or model and going, okay, let's forget about neurotypical people. What does it take for us to lead a fulfilling life? What would make somebody with ADHD happy, and what would make me happy? And I want to talk to people about what they incorporate into their lives, because I think that it's not only the issue isn't only that we're trying to pursue things in neurotypical ways, but a lot of the times I think we're trying to pursue neurotypical goals that wouldn't actually make us happy. And so I want to get curious about what actually is important to incorporate into our lives. How can we be happy? How can we be fulfilled, as opposed to how can we just be more neurotypical or function more, you know, in a neurotypical world? How can we really build lives that fit our brains? And so I think that's probably what book number two is going to be. And I'm not going to start writing that for a while, but I'm going to start exploring content about that. How do we figure out what our values are and what our needs are, and how do we get that met? And how do we lean into our strengths as opposed to just trying to mitigate our challenges?
That's amazing. So in this next book, whenever you do write it and life allows, are you going to be talking about parenting and coping with ADHD while you're parent? I have a good friend, Erica. She's like, I bet her next book is going to be about parenting with ADHD. So do you think that you'll be putting anything like that in it?
I think that's part of building a fulfilling life, is for a lot of people, they want to have kids, and that's part of being fulfilled. And then how do you balance, you know, being a good mom and being a good parent with also having your own interests and your own, you know, your own personal fulfillment? How do you support a child, but also model to them what it's like to be a whole and fulfilled human being, because that's equally important. But it's that book, I'm not saying I won't do a book on parenting with ADHD, but that book is not primarily about parenting. It'll include it, but you know, all of this could also go out the window as soon as I have the kid and I'm like, whoa, people need to know about this. This is horrible. We need more support. Like, who knows, right?
Right.
I'm trying to have like a lighter grip this time on what I think is going to happen. But I am right now excited about a book that explores how do we build ourselves a fulfilling life, because right now so much of the goal for people who are who have ADHD is how do I get to be more functional? How do I get to be more neurotypical? How do I fix me? How do I get to the point where I'm not struggling so hard? And I would love to see us shift that goal to how do I build a life that fits me, as opposed to how do I fit into this life that I'm supposed to live?
Oh my gosh. So many golden nuggets dropped within this, less than an hour. And Jessica, I cannot thank you enough for being on the podcast, for being so vulnerable and sharing everything on your channel and your book. I mean, everywhere. Your book really is what you had envisioned, where it feels like just if we were to have sat down and had a coffee with you and you told us everything. I mean, it's just amazing. Thank you so much for everything you do for the ADHD community.
Thank you so much for having me and for paying for some baby clothes. I really appreciate the support.
You are so welcome. All right. Bye, my friends, with the Outsmart ADHD podcast. We'll see you next week.
All right. Bye, Jamie.
Are you a high-achieving woman with ADHD looking for a coach? Or maybe an event coordinator looking for a wildly captivating speaker? Perfect. Go to outsmartadhd.co. That's outsmartadhd.co. to get in touch. And before I forget, would you mind taking a minute to share this podcast with someone you love? It would mean the world to me. Thanks, my friend. Until next time.